Hey folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, it's the best of secret stories, stories about people keeping or sharing or uncovering secrets. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Lily B. and Ben Lerman. But first, here's Steve Heisler with a story he first shared on the podcast in 2012. You can find him at steveheisler.com. And here he is now with a story we call The White Horse.
So when I was 9 years old, I was living in a suburb of Chicago, and I felt completely out of control. I had a younger brother who was 3 years younger than I was, and I fought with him constantly. And I had an even younger sister who was 7 years younger than I was, so she was still pretty much a baby. And my mom showered her with attention. And so in my mind, I was not getting anything that I needed, and I felt completely lost, and I would take it out on my brother. To the point in which my mom completely lost her shit and had to institute things like regimented dinner times. We would both be in our room, and my brother would come down and have like a 6 o'clock seating. And then he would go back to his room at 6:30, and I would come down and have a 6:30 seating. And the last thing that she tried was that she sent us all to therapy. And I hated therapy because to me, I was a smart kid even at nine. And I think I just saw right through it. I just thought it was bullshit. What happens when you're 9 years old and you don't actually want to talk to the therapist is that he makes you play games. And one of the things that he had was a whole big set of Legos. And I was a huge Lego junkie at the time. I had so many Legos. And one day, the therapist was talking about something, and I just had this impulse to take one of the pieces and put it in my pocket. And I did. And I had these like giant MC Hammer pants. So they were like neon, and they were big and puffy, and they could fit so many Legos inside of them. But I just took this one piece, and two things happened simultaneously. The first was this feeling that just started in my chest and went out into my fingertips and eventually made its way up to my brain. And my brain was just firing off all these scenarios that had no basis in reality as to how terrible my life was going to become now that I was somebody who stole something. The world was going to end. I would never be able to achieve true happiness or find true love. I would never be able to play Nintendo ever again. And the other feeling, though, was just this sense of complete relief. I remember thinking to myself, wow, I actually did take that piece. I can do something for myself. I can have this control that I've always wanted. And I left the therapist's office, and I had my hand in my pocket because I wanted to make sure that this piece was still there. And my mom said to me, why is your hand in your pocket? And I said, no reason. And she said, is there anything in your pocket? And I took out the piece, and she said, where did you get that? I said, oh, my friend Aaron gave this to me because his sister had too many of them, and he said that it was okay for me to take it, and he told me that it had to be a secret, so I couldn't tell anybody. And actually, he gave it to me a couple of days ago, and I've had it this whole time. It's not new. I didn't just get it just now. I definitely have had it for many days, and I definitely got it from Aaron, and he got it from his sister, and she has so many of them. And my mom looked at me, and I could tell that she was skeptical, but she just said, okay. And I remember thinking, I got away with it. I can do this, and I need to do this again immediately. So I went to my friend Aaron's house shortly thereafter, and I spent a lot of time there because his life was like this funhouse mirror version of my life. His life was full of Now and Later candy and Kraft mac and cheese and micro machines. He had so many micro machines, these tiny little cars that he would play with in a crawl space. And I loved the fact that he had a crawl space. It was his own space. Nobody could get in there. Literally no one. It was tiny. And I was so envious that he had this little space that he could keep all of his toys and be completely in control and escape the world. And I decided when I went over there one day that I wanted to take some of those micro machines for myself. Wearing the same MC Hammer pants, I very quickly stuffed a bunch of those micro machines into my pocket. And again, those two simultaneous feelings came back. I immediately saw myself as a terrible person. But this feeling of, I can't believe I did it. I can't believe I got away with it. And I would play with them at home, only behind my bed so that nobody could see, because I was too ashamed to bring them out, because I didn't want to face the fact that I had actually taken them. And I figured if no one ever knew, then it would be okay. And one day my mom walked in while I was doing that, and I immediately dropped them and stood up. And she said, "What do you have behind the bed?" I said, "Nothing." And she walked around the bed, and I didn't stop her. And she saw this flimsy bag of micro machines that I had. And she picked it up as if it was weed and said, "Where did you get this?" And I said, "Oh, I just got it from somebody." And she said, "Did you get it from Aaron?" I said, "Yeah, I got it from Aaron. You know, his sister had a bunch of extras. And so he said, you know, it was totally okay with her. I could take as many as I wanted. You know, you could check with them, but, you know, you don't have to. It's totally fine." And again, I saw her look at me questionably and just say, "Okay." And just like before, I felt like, wow, I really can do this. I can pull this off. And look at all these micro machines I have now. I need to be able to pull this off, because I get toys and I can have my own little crawl space in my room where it's just my things, and my things can be mine regardless of who they originated from. My parents had a very strict regimen on how many toys I could buy. I was a very compulsive kid, so whenever I wanted something, I wanted it immediately. If I saw a Lego piece that I wanted to go buy, I wanted it yesterday. And they were always of the mindset of, well, just because you want something immediately doesn't mean that you can have it right away. So suddenly, if I wanted something, I could have it. And I didn't have to ask permission. I could just have it for myself. And it felt so empowering. To me, it was worth dealing with this terrible anxiety to get the outcome that I wanted. So then I went to Van's house. Van was a friend of mine from school. And Van had so many more Legos than I have ever seen in my entire life. He had just received for Christmas, I think, this special medieval set. I think it cost $50, and it came with all assortment of medieval-themed Legos. There were guys with swords, there were dragons, and above all, there was this one white horse. And in the Lego community, of which I clearly was a big connoisseur, you could not get the white horse in anything other than this $50 medieval set. And $50 was like a fictional amount of money to me at that point. So I went over to his house and took the white horse and slid it into my MC Hammer pants when he wasn't looking. And that felt so easy. It was too easy at this point. So I kept on taking Legos. For about an hour, I slowly but surely filled my pockets until they were literally bulging with Legos. It just so happened that that was the day that Van also decided to show me his other Christmas gift, which was the track and field video game for Nintendo, but you played it on this pad that you would lay out. So you had to run back and forth on the pad. And I got on the pad completely naive to the fact that my pockets were full of Legos, and I just remember the crunch, 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 crunch of my feet as I was running on this pad. And Van is not stupid. He was like, "Why is your leg crunching as you're running?" And I couldn't think of what to say, so I said, "Oh, I just put a bunch of your Legos in my pockets. But don't worry, I'm actually doing this for your benefit because I'm really good at track and field, and I'm thinking that if I weigh myself down, then you'll have a good chance of winning, and I'm going to definitely put them back." And he looked at me just like my mom did, and he just said, "Okay." So I took them out of my pockets, and as we played the game, I kept on putting a couple more back in my pockets. And when I left, I had taken more Legos than I had even taken the first time. And I got home and I dumped them all onto my bed, and the white horse was right there in the middle. The white horse that I wanted so badly. And I looked at all of those Legos and all of that dread, all of that anxiety that I didn't feel when I took them completely washed over me 10 times more than it had before. I didn't want to be that person who was taking things from people, but I had already done it. And so I put those Legos in a deep drawer where my other Legos were, but way in the back, and I didn't play with them. Because for whatever reason, when having to face it made me feel extremely uncomfortable. And 3 years later, I was in seventh grade, And I wanted to rent a video game. And in my house, I was only allowed to rent a video game when I had a friend come over. And I kind of went eeny, meeny, miny, moe in the phone book, and I invited Van over. And we were sitting in the basement playing the game. And it felt like I had just played for like 5 or 10 minutes. And Van said, "When's my turn?" I said, "Oh, your turn is coming up soon." And I played for what felt like 5 more minutes. And he said, "I'm going to go check out what you have in your room." And then 5 minutes later, he came back and he continued to watch me. And then he said, "All right, I'm going to go home." And then I came upstairs after he left and I looked at the clock and an hour and a half had passed. I had completely lost myself in this video game. Then I had this sneaking suspicion that something had changed. And I went up to my room and I opened the drawer of Legos that I hadn't opened in 3 years. And I reached way into the back and I pulled out a handful of all those medieval Legos that I had taken from Van, and the white horse was not there. And in that moment, I felt absolutely nothing. That white horse to me was just some Lego. At the time, it was so special. But 3 years later, it meant absolutely nothing. And then years went by. This was seventh grade. I now am 30 years old. And Van Miller came up in my Facebook feed. And I decided, what the hell? I've always thought that maybe he had taken the white horse back, but I wasn't really sure. So I sent him a message on Facebook that said, "Hey, Van, this is sort of strange. I know we haven't talked in a long time, but I have a question for you. When I was a kid, I stole a bunch of your Legos, and I want to talk to you about it." And within 15 seconds, I had a call from him. And he was like, "Oh my God, you are so right." And I said, "I'm so sorry. I was this completely out of control kid. I'm really sorry. I can't believe that I did that to you." And he told me his recollection of the events. He told me that he watched me take his Legos and was confused as to why a kid would take something from him. And then he remembers me leaving, and he said to his mom, "I think Steve stole my Legos." And his mom called my mom and asked her, who presumably asked me. And at that point, I was probably staring at my haul of Legos that I had placed onto the bed and was so terrified that I was going to get in the worst trouble of my life that I just vehemently denied it. And she lied for me, and she told his mom that I didn't take them. And in that moment, Van felt he didn't know what to do. He had relied on adults to take care of justice in the world, to be the barometer as to what was good and what was evil. And at this point, adults were letting him down and he was confused. 3 years later, when he came to my house, he had this passing whim to go into my room and open the drawer of Legos. And he saw that white horse. And he slipped it into his pocket and he left. And he told me that that white horse came to symbolize his ability to take justice into his own hands, to have the confidence in himself that he could right the wrongs in the world, that he didn't need anybody else, that he could be completely self-reliant. So I realized that in stealing Van's white horse, I had given him this gift of self-confidence and control that I had so badly wanted as a fourth grader. And so now, as a 30-year-old man, I can't help but think, what else can I steal?
We'll be right back. We're back.
So my story starts out in Indiana, where I grew up in an Orthodox... Oh, we got some Hoosiers in the house, like you do. And so I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. Happy Passover, everybody. Happy Pesach, if there's any Orthodox Jews. So I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family, and we were a little loose in my family. I had my extended family was for real, like Black Hat, and you know what I'm talking about. But my family, like, we drove on Saturday, and super Orthodox cousins lived across the street. So when my parents would drive us to, like, Little League, we would duck in the car if we saw them. That's the situation. Anyway, so I grew up in South Bend, Indiana, and when I was 17, I went to prom, and after prom... my friend Jenna, who got me into smoking a little marijuana. I don't think my mother's forgiven her yet. It's been a wonderful, wonderful time ever since then. But Jenna and I decided, well, Jenna was a big Deadhead, and she had a lot of friends who were Deadheads, and she invited me to come with her to this Dead show, and I was going to drive us, and I was borrowing my dad's car, so I couldn't tell my parents that we were going, because they would, you know, they would know that there was a real problem. They would have a real problem with that. So I made up this lie, and I told my parents that we were going to an amusement park not far from where the Dead show was happening. It was in Ohio, and Buckeye Lake, Ohio was the show. I told them we were going to Sandusky, Ohio, to Cedar Point Amusement Park. A little kernel of truth. A little kernel in the lie. Very important. So Jenna and I and Jenna's friend Carol got in this car to my dad's car to go see the Grateful Dead. And we had to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and leave real early because part of the fun, apparently, this was all new to me, but according to Jenna, part of the fun was everything that happened before the show and through. There's a whole counterculture scene going on with, you know, fire jugglers and lots of drugs. Lots and lots of drugs. So we got in the car, 6 a.m., and set out bright and early on a Saturday morning, day after prom. And about 3 hours into the trip, after the second joint is going around the car, be careful if you're driving through Indiana and Ohio. There are stone teenagers on the road. The second joint's going around, and I take a hit, and I have an epiphany. And my reaction to this epiphany, driving down the highway, is to say, "Fuck! Fuck! Oh, fuck! Shit! Fuck!" And I pulled over and screeched on the brakes and pulled into the shoulder there, and I just tried to catch my breath. Jenna is like, what the fuck's going on? What the fuck's going on? What was that? What is that all about? What is that? What's going on? Are you okay? What's happening?" And I said, "Carol, she was not the sharpest tool in the shed. She sort of was like a, what I just remember, I just picture the face of Janice the Muppet. I think that's accurate. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly. But I'm very, you know, a little Deadhead." And she's like, "What's going on, man? Is everything cool?" You know, Jenna is like, "What is happening?" I said, "We have to turn around. We have to go back." And she's like, "We can't go back. We're going to meet Jenna's friends and her boyfriend. And we can't turn back. We can't." And she was right. We couldn't turn back. We were too far. 3 hours. We would have missed the whole thing. So I had to do some quick thinking, because what had happened was this. The day before, I had purchased a video cassette tape. Some of you might not know what that is. It's like an old, QuickTime. It's an old QuickTime. It's like a, you can buy them at different stores. I had purchased this VHS tape at a small bookstore. And had left this tape in the VCR. It contained a movie on this tape. It was an independent film by the title of Bus Depot was the name of this. And I'll just sum it up for you real quick. It was a story about men who were ostensibly strangers, and they would meet in the bathroom of the Bus Depot, the eponymous Bus Depot. And they would have very intense friendships. And then depart, just leave for places unknown. The director left that open. Where you never found out where they were going after that. Didn't find out. But I very much enjoyed this film. It was a good one. I left it in the VCR in my parents' living room and then drove 3 hours into Ohio. And I was totally freaking out, not knowing what to do. And I couldn't come clean to Jenna. And I just had to figure things out. I was like, okay, we won't turn around, but I have to stop at the next service plaza. Because in my mind, I was like, I knew I had to go into damage control, because it was like the worst possible, like, nightmare scenarios were playing in my mind of what would happen, right? Like, that my dad would find it, because one time I rented a movie called The Last American Virgin, and that was just like a teenage comedy romp, and he was like, "What the hell is this crap?" And he wasn't happy about the Last American Virgin. So I knew he would, and you did not want to incur the wrath of my father. It was a much, much better relationship we have now. Anyway, that was my little cousins across the street, 12 and 13-year-old cousins, like, they might want to come over and watch, like, Aladdin or whatever Disney movie was popular at the time, and instead be treated to Bus Depot. And then my dad would find out. So I had to do some damage control. So I said, okay, I'm going to stop at the next service plaza, and I'm going to call home, and I'm call my mom. And Jenna was like, okay. She was just willing to let it go because I had agreed not to ruin her life by turning around. It was totally grounds for ruining someone's life at that age. So the next service plaza comes. I get out of the car, and I made my way to the payphone. A payphone is this box you put money into, and it would place a cell call for you. I called home, and as the phone was ringing, I was really bracing myself because I realized, like, this is sort of a turning point moment for me, and I knew that things could really change going forward. And my mom answered, and I was relieved that she answered, and she said, "Is everything okay?" And I was like, yes, everything is okay. But I have to tell you something. And she said, yeah. And I said, well, there are these kids at school that think I'm gay. And they planted a tape in my car. And I watched it, and it was pornography. It was homosexual pornography. And I was just horrified by it, and I turned it off, and I forgot about it right there in the VCR. And she's like, uh-huh. And I said, would you take it out for me just so nobody gets the wrong idea? And she was like, okay. I was like, great. Well, and she was like, okay, well, have a nice time at Cedar Point. And I was like, "Will, and thanks, Mom. I appreciate it." And we said goodbye, and I was so relieved that she had bought my story about that. And it was almost to the point where I started to believe it a little bit, you know. But I just felt relieved, and I felt better. And there was a lot going through my mind about, like, maybe she didn't believe it. And I got back to the car, and we start driving. And another joint goes around, and Carol is like, yeah, man. And then Jenna is like, what the fuck? What the fuck is going on? You have to tell me now what the fuck is going on. And I knew that this was a moment where I could unburden myself of this weight I'd been carried around. And I took a deep breath, and I looked at Jenna, and I said, there are these kids at school that think I'm gay. And I planted a tape in my car. Jenna was like, uh-huh. And we just agreed to let it go. And we got real high. And we made it safely without incident to the Grateful Dead show. And eventually did make it home. And, later on, I did come out to my mom officially, who had not bought the story. It turned out, did not buy the story at all. And I was about to go be a foreign exchange student for a year in Brussels, and but my mom really wanted me to come out to my dad. So she sort of set it up that he would take me to the airport, and it worked out really well because at the airport, you know, basically it was like, Dad, I'm gay, I'll see you in a year. That was very nice. I'm lucky to have such warm and supportive parents, and I do realize that. And I would just close this story up with this. I don't know how long it was later, but a little while later, I was talking about this with my mom, and we were laughing a little bit. And I asked her, so did you watch Bus Depot? And she said she did. And I said, were you disgusted by it? And she said, and I don't know if she was kidding or not, but she said, no, I was kind of turned on. There it is. Thank you.
The year is 1983. I'm about 5 years old. My grandmother had picked me up from school that day and told me to go to my room, a jugar con mis Barbies, is what she would say. Go play with your Barbies. And I did. And I'm playing with my Barbies. It's about 3 o'clock. And all of a sudden, the front door swings open and my mom comes storming in. Like, I run to the door of my room and she, like, passes right in front of me, like, fast and with, like, weight on her feet. See, my mom's only, like, 4'11". She's tiny. To this day, she's tiny. But, like, the weight on her feet made her seem bigger. And then she grabbed some bags and just started throwing stuff into bags and then walking to the front door and just throwing stuff. My daddy's stuff off the porch. I didn't ask any questions because I had never, ever seen my sweet, tiny mom act this way. See, my mom's religious and she's very patient and understanding, and God will look out and he'll take care of us. So to see this woman who was just like on a mission, I didn't say anything. I stood in my doorway and watched as she made several trips back and forth and throughout the house, crying and just mumbling things in Spanish to herself, like, no lo puedo creer, como es posible, how is this possible, I can't believe it. And then like 15 minutes later, my dad comes strolling in, not strolling, I mean, he was like, same heaviness, like looking for her, and then they're just like lip boxing is what I call it, because they're not touching each other, but they're yelling at each other, and she is saying, no es posible, no puedo creer, David, no lo puedo creer, and he is just saying, Morena, por favor, entiende, entiende, por favor, understand, understand, please, Morena, which means dark skin, because my mom's very dark skin, Morena, por favor, entiende, entiende, and she's like, no, no, David, I don't want to understand. And I'm sitting there just watching this and just thinking, what is going on? My mom was like, no, David, no. And I'm like, no, what? What can't you believe, Mom? What's going on? And for 11 years, I wanted to know. I searched for this truth that for 11 years, no one would mention, Mom, why? And everything I asked just made my mom seem more guilty to me and more like it was her fault because he was saying he was sorry and you didn't want to listen to him. And why aren't you listening to him when he said he was sorry? And everything I asked, and I'd ask my grandma and she'd be like, ask your mother. And I'd ask my mother and she'd say, sepas cuando vas a saber. Like, you'll know when you know. But she never said anything, and for 11 years, I did not like this woman. She took away my daddy. My daddy was gone. My daddy. I mean, when she avoided the questions, or when she was like, well, still talk to your father and have a relationship with him. I'm like, well, why? If you don't like him so much, why should I like him? And she's like, that's your father. Call him. Talk to him. So fine. My grandmother dies in 1996 of a brain aneurysm, and we all have to go to Texas. This is 11 years later. And I just happened to be 6.5 months pregnant, 16 years old. And because I'm 16 and pregnant, I can't do what everyone else gets to do when someone dies in my family, which is celebrate and drink and party and have a good time. I am left babysitting the drunk people in my family, which is fun. It is. Trust me, I have some good drunks in my family. And I'm sitting outside with my tia abuela, who is my mom's sister. And I'm sitting out there, and now my tia abuela, when she gets to drinking, she's fun. She's such a fun drunk. She gets to, like, helping you, like, giving you recipes, and she gets to showing you how to, like, make patterns on sewing machines and, like, doing her little thing. I mean, my aunt, Weta, is cool as fuck. She's so great. But, like, people don't like her and my family because she does drink. And when she gets drunk, these lips get to moving, like, too much. They get to just... So everybody rolls their eyes and walks away, and I'm sitting there babysitting my Aunt Weta, and then the Weta starts to ask me about my baby. And I'm all like, yep, I'll talk about my baby because it's my baby, and I'm kind of like self-absorbed like that sometimes when it comes to my baby. If you knew him, you'd understand why, but... She's asking me about him, and she's telling me, you know, like, how's your baby, and how's his father, and how, oh, yeah, he's great. He's, like, part of the baby's life, and he wants to be there, and until this day, he still is. And she was just like, and how did things work out with your dad? And I'm sort of just like, eh, you know, I mean, I don't see my dad. He doesn't come to see us. And I'm kind of like saying, but it's totally my mom's fault because of that. Like, you know, because she drove my daddy away. And she's like, ¿cómo? Like, ¿cómo que tu mamá le hizo eso a tu papá? ¿Cómo que es culpa de tu mamá? Like, how is it your mom's fault? And I explained to her, like, I remember, and I explain what I remember. And she's like, ay, mija, oh, honey, let me tell you something. So I guess the way the story goes is that my mother, my wonderful little tiny religious mother, had suspected my dad of cheating on her. And she tells my grandma that morning, she says, will you take care of the kids? Will you take them to school? Will you pick them up? And if David asks where I am at, you confirm that I have a doctor's appointment, mom, okay? And she tells David, my dad, mira, I tengo que ir al doctor. And she said, and my dad's like, okay, está bien. And I guess he was just like, all right, because my mom doesn't lie. My mom is not that person. My mom is, you know, straight up, you know, sit, stand, kneel all day. So she doesn't. So he's like, all right, cool, no problem. And so while he's sleeping that morning, she goes into our conversion van, those like 70s vans where, like, y'all know the vans where the back is like two benches on the side and then you lift up the cushions and you put the slats across and it makes a bed with a space in the middle, which is maybe 2 feet by 1 foot, maybe. There's a little gap in between the two benches. And so my mom in the morning gets up and squeezes her tiny little 4'11" ass in the gap of that fucking bench. Like, she shimmies her way in there with her head facing the front of the car, the front of the van. And as she's laying there, she's like thinking, I guess she had to be thinking, because I don't know. Like, I'm gonna catch this motherfucker, I'm gonna catch him. And so my dad drives, gets up in the morning, none the wiser. We're already at school, and takes his ass to work. He gets to work at 9 o'clock, and there my mom is, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 11:45 maybe, 12 o'clock. He comes out, gets into his van, and goes to lunch. Drives to somewhere, I don't know, this woman's job, and picks the woman up. Now they're both sitting in the front talking and yapping, and my mom's just laying there listening like, I got you, motherfucker, I got you, I got you. And what do? But they go to a park, they park the van, And they go to the back of the van and sit on the bed right above my mama. I mean, seriously, if she'd have farted, they'd have smelled it. If she'd have coughed, they'd have heard that shit. So my mom's just sitting there, and then they get to talking and chatting and flirting and kissing, and then fucking right above my mama. Had this been me in the back of this van. Crime of passion. Crime of fucking passion. I swear would have been on the news that day. It had to come out drenched in blood. Like, yep, yep. I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I did it. But not my fucking mama. My mom laid there in that little hole and listen to the fucking and the oh yeses and David and Marta and listen to this. And then worse, the post-coital conversations of I'm gonna leave her for you. I love you. Again, couldn't have been me. And my mom lays there, and now it's what, 1 o'clock, because I get an hour lunch. Drives her back home. I'm back to work. And then he's driving back to work. And my mother, like a little like soldier ninja, crawls her ass out to start. And does it so slick, because from what, I mean, I gather all this now, like later, but she gets up, sits right in the passenger seat. Yup. I'd have choked him so bad, I'd have been like, right behind him. But I didn't, but she did it. She sat right next to him and was like, hola, David. Hi, David. And he thought he saw a fucking ghost. Like, what? ¿Cómo? 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 ¿De dónde viniste? ¿De dónde? ¿De dónde? And she's like, where the fuck you think I was, bro? Like, seriously, ¿de dónde crees? ¿De dónde crees, güey? ¿De dónde crees? And he's like, of course, like, almost crashes into the median, pulls into, like, a mini mall or something, and they sit there again in lip box. No lo puedo creer, David. Ya tengo la prueba. Ya tengo la prueba que necesito. I have the proof I need. Ya, David. And he's begging and pleading her, and I guess they're just, like, talking, and he talks her down from her anger and her rage, and he's just like, mira, morena, it was, like, a one-time thing. Es nomás una vez que ha pasado. And she's like, no, no lo creo. I don't believe you. And she, and they calm down. They get to a point where I guess my dad calms her the fuck down, and she calms down enough to say, you know what? We will talk about this. Look, let's go home. We'll talk about this. And as she leaned over to, like, give him a hug to say, you know what? I understand. She kicks that motherfucker out the van. Opens the door really quick. Little 4'11" ass kicked his ass out the van. To, like, I don't, he didn't expect it, but she did. She kicked him out the van, and she took that van home. I'm sitting here listening to my Aunt Weta tell me this, and I'm like, what? What? Because I have been an asshole for 11 fucking years. I, no joke, like, I was an asshole. Like, you ain't nobody, I don't love you, you took away my daddy. I was an asshole. And it just hit me. I was, like, pale, I was, like, sick, I was nauseous. I was just like, what do you mean? This cannot be true. And she's like, and her drunk ass was like, sí, mija, sí. Así pasó la cosa. I'm like, no. No. Because my daddy was everything. And he was a good dad. Like, don't get me wrong, he's a horrible fucking husband. But, like, a good dad. And I just, like, all my memories of my dad were, like, fucking rainbows and everything. It was, like, beautiful. And now I got this, like, what? Moment. Now, my mom was doing this 7-day vigil, so it was like she'd come back every morning, so I was sitting there all night, like, nauseous, and just like, oh my gosh, I have to talk to my mom, but there was no cell phones at the time, it's 90 fucking six, and I'm just like, I can't call her and be like, what the fuck, mom? And so I have to wait, and she gets back that morning, and like, I totally, like, before she even gets to my inside my tia Weta's house, I'm just like, look, we gotta talk. And I walk, and I talk with her, and I have my arm around my little tiny 4'11" mom. I'm like, so listen, I was talking to Tia Weta last night, and I could feel her stiffen up a little. Oh, shit. And she had some interesting things to say about what happened that day I remember you and Dad fighting. And she said, ¿qué te dijo? Like, what'd she say? I'm like, everything. Everything, everything. And she's like, pues sí, así pasó la cosa. Like, nothing. Like, I wasn't an asshole to her, and now she didn't give me this, like, yeah, bitch, now what? What you gotta say now? Like, none of that. It was just like, yep, that's how it happened. And I was like, why? Why, mom? Why didn't you just tell me? Why didn't you just... And she, before I could even continue to ask, she's like, mira, that's your father. And you are going to love your father. Because that's your father, not your husband. And he was a horrible husband, yes, but not all men are like that. And that was that's my cross to bear. Not yours. And I was like, fuck. Because seriously, like, at that moment, I was like, fuck that dude. Fuck him. Are you serious? I learned something. Like, I am a true believer in that everything that we feel and witness and hear and experience go to shape us in some way or another. They make us who we are. And sometimes what we don't know we're here is used the same way. I learned that day two very, very important things. My mom is a badass motherfucker, man. She's so bad. Oh, man, because again, it could not have been me. It could not have been. And two was that she did it and did everything for us. For me, she put up with the fucking yelling and the name calling and the, I wish I wasn't here, I want to go. She put up with so much to make sure that my vision of men was never, let's say, fucked up. I thank her for that. I look at her and I'm just like, man, mom, thank you. Because I probably would have thought that about all men. And I wouldn't be raising a young man right now the way I'd be raising him had I known different. And I wouldn't be friends with his dad. And I wouldn't be friends with all the men that I know. And I wouldn't be going on dates like crazy either. Right? So I thank her for that. And I thank you guys for listening.
This is Risk. This is Elvis Costello behind me now, and we just heard from Lily B, who you can find on Instagram at LilyB606, a story called The Great Detective. And before that, we heard from Ben Lerman, who you can find on Instagram at It's Raining Ben. That's rain like royalty rains. And Ben's story is called Intense Friendships at the Bus Depot. Well, that's it for the Best of Secret Stories. And if you've got a story about a secret, either keeping one, finding one, or sharing one, share it with us. and maybe you can be on the next episode of this series. Everything you need to know about how to pitch us your story is at risk-show.com/submissions. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.